Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what do the numbers say about racially profiling within the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office? And more people are becoming eco-chaplains today to help people suffering from existential climate grief. But first this morning, the United States Congress is closer than ever to creating a federal commission to document the traumatic past of indigenous boarding schools in the country, something activists have pushed for years. It would be called the Truth and Healing Commission, and a bipartisan pair of representatives reintroduced it in the House of Representatives last month. An identical bill has already passed in the Senate previously. The effort would not only give an official avenue for survivors to tell their stories, it would investigate the role the federal government played in the boarding schools. Our own Indigenous Affairs reporter, Gabriel Pietrazio, joins me now to tell us more about why this would be such a monumental step forward for many tribal communities and peoples. Good morning, Gabe.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so tell us first, what exactly would this Truth and Healing Commission do?
Yeah, I think the concept of truth and reconciliation and healing commissions is kind of foreign to Americans here. Dozens of countries around the world actually use and turn to such commissions for what's called restorative justice work, and sometimes even healing, as you mentioned. Most notably, like South Africa had created one in the fallout of apartheid, and then Canada more recently in 2008. And they were the first really to create their own commission to address what they refer to as residential schools in Canada, which are the same as U.S. Indian boarding schools, just for the First Nations of Canada. And as part of the reconciliation efforts, the then Prime Minister Stephen Harper apologized in the House of Commons. And then years later, Justin Trudeau also apologized to survivors. And so then a couple of years after that, the late Pope Francis took this penitential pilgrimage to apologize for the Catholic Church's role in Canada for essentially running these residential schools. And what we've seen is this trickle-down effect that is leading to, in the U.S., a boarding school apology under President Joe Biden, former president, and that paved the way essentially for this commission to come forward to make it more mainstream and more popular in a lot of ways to accept wrongdoing and fault for running such institutions.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But I want to back up for a minute, Gabe, and just talk about the history here. Remind us a little bit about what this was about. These boarding schools existed for generations up until the 1970s. They were all over the country, including here in Arizona. And they were essentially like tools of assimilation, right?
Essentially, they started 1820s or so, give or take. It was about 150-year legacy.
Wow. Yeah.
We talk about it as a campaign of assimilation. In Arizona, the latest counts show that at least 50 federal boarding schools were run here. That's federally run or federally funded. And that could include institutions like the Catholic Church, Jesuits, Episcopalians, things of that sort, Protestants. Mm-hmm. Second overall state behind Oklahoma, which tips the scale at about 80,
wow,
give or take. And for context, we had about 417. That's according to numbers identified by the Interior Department to date of them. And they're still finding them. They're still finding records of new, undiscovered boarding schools just because of the lack of record keeping, but also just the loss of history, as you mentioned, over generations. You know, generations of children were lost these institutions. Mm-hmm. The government found that, about 1,000 confirmed deaths. The Washington Post found three times as many,
right,
as part of their federal investigation, their initiative under Deb Haaland, who was the former Interior Secretary under Biden. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. The apology, but also the boarding school federal investigation were just kind of like the stepping stones for a full-on commission that would kind of air out all these issues.
Right. Okay. And that's what we're looking at in Congress now. So I mentioned advocates in Indian country have been pushing for a federal effort like this for a very long time. Why didn't this happen until now? You talked about that apology from the president, from President Biden years ago, just a couple of years ago here in Arizona. And you were there, right?
That's right. I think what I have heard over the last decade covering boarding schools is that some survivors thought this day would never come, that the government would never accept fault for what they did, for what they allowed to do these institutions onto indigenous peoples, and to effectively get away with it. So this has been a discussion in Indian country for decades, as you mentioned, generations, that there should be some sort of accounting for what has happened. It didn't really translate to Capitol Hill until the last decade or so. And that's where we kind of see these apologies from both Pope Francis, the late Pope Francis, and President Joe Biden have a lot of resonance for, you know, essentially to sway lawmakers who are on the sidelines about, oh, should I really support this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, encourage them to be like, this is justified, that there's some meaning to this.
Yeah. And let's hear a little bit from the Pope, the former Pope, and the former president about those apologies.
Pido perdón humildemente por el mal que tantos cristianos cometieron contra los pueblos indígenas.
I humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against the indigenous peoples.
I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize. It's long overdue.
So, Gabe, what does it mean to folks here in Indian country who have talked, who you've talked to about this, like that Congress is taking steps, getting closer to making this commission happen?
It's really important, and some people have dedicated their lives to this. A lot of people have dedicated their lives to making this happen. The National Boarding School Healing Coalition, one of the strongest advocates for this space. I actually spent some time when they were here at Gila River gathering boarding school survivor testimonies, the same place where Biden uttered that apology we just heard.
Yeah.
And time and again, we hear how important this is, that the government is taking an active look and focus and interest in telling the story, retelling and sharing this story of pain, of trauma, of intergenerational harm with people, and to show that, you know, this happened and, you know, to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the last part of what this commission would do that's in the title there, that healing part, right? Like, this would put people in charge of, yes, investigating the past, yes, documenting it in a kind of a formal way. But it would also hope to establish some kind of path to healing. What might that look like?
They talked about in the legislation a couple of different committees that would effectively help facilitate such healing through, you know, gathering testimony and things of that sort. Earlier this month, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops sent a letter to the Senate in support of the latest version of the bill, writing that the church is committed to transparency, listening, and humility, and that they have a seat at the table to help, you know, understand and unpack what has happened. And one of the challenges that we're seeing is that there's this boat of contention over one of the things Congress can do is have subpoena powers, which would allow them to force people into Congress to testify, to hand over documents and things of that sort. And it seems, at least in the current version of the bill, that that wouldn't be taking place. And it was it was praised by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, saying that excluding that broad power would invite greater cooperative and transparent participation among all stakeholders, essentially. So there's kind of this tug and pull of, we could do, you know, good restorative work, that we could help repair families and understand what has happened. But there's also kind of give and take, that how far could this commission effectively go if it is finalized?
All right. Lots to watch for still. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrarazzo joining us. Gabe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan and Republican allies have been pushing for an end to court oversight of his department for months now. Sheridan argues that the department is not the same one it was under former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and his officers do not racially profile. But our next guest this morning found the data paints a different picture. Rafael Carranza is a reporter for Arizona Luminaria and reported the story for ProPublica's local reporting network. And he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So Jerry Sheridan was Joe Arpaio's number two for some time when he was sheriff decades ago. And he saw this kind of original case that led to this court-appointed monitor play out firsthand. But as he ran for sheriff, as he took office, he has said that he does not think this oversight is necessary anymore. And he's not the only one saying that right now. So tell us why. What's his argument?
So his argument is that, the original case stemming from racial profiling allegations all the way back to 2007. This is a very long-running case. There was a settlement in 2013 that pretty much dictates everything that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office does now. And so Sheriff Sheridan's argument, as well as those of Republican Board of Supervisors, is that the department has done enough, since 2013, when the court first imposed those reforms, that it's now a completely different agency that no longer racially profiles. And Sheridan actually credits the reforms that the federal judge imposed mm-hmm. As one of the reasons why, he believes that the department is one of like one of the best departments in the country because of all the requirements that they must comply with in order to ensure that they're not racially profiling or that there's no racial bias in a lot of these traffic stops.
Interesting. You looked at the data though. Here, there's a lot of data as part of the settlement, right? The MCSO has to keep kind of incredibly detailed records of things like traffic stops, investigations into officers, more than that. Tell us what the data says. It paints a different story.
There's so much, again, because it is such a big case, and there's a lot of reporting requirements. There's 13 data points that any deputy has to write down after interacting with the public, and then that information then gets parsed out into multiple reports. And there are quarterly reviews. There are also monthly reviews of individual deputies. So if they found to have disparities, then the department can act on what's behind those disparities. And so the sheriff has said that many of these monthly reviews have not shown that any deputies have been involved in racial profiling. But I think the point of contention here is this annual traffic report that the department itself, is paying and funding a contracting with a nonprofit to analyze all the data. And what this annual report has found is that there are, some disparities in the interactions with drivers. And the main focus of this lawsuit is with Latino drivers because they're considered the plaintiff class. The lawsuit stemmed from racial profiling against Latinos. And so they're the ones that are covered with this settlement. But this last report from 2024 also found that there were, that traffic stops involving Black drivers who are not covered in the settlement were also taking longer than compared to white drivers. And so these yearly reports are the ones that identify the disparities that the sheriff's department must then kind of, address. But that's also, that's one of the key components that the sheriff's office must comply with in order to get out of the court oversight, is ensuring that there are no more of these racial disparities in these annual reports. And that's one of the big holdups that has kept the judge from releasing the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office from court oversight.
Right. And it's one of the few, like they are mostly there otherwise, which is always interesting to point out. I want to ask Rafael about the activists, right, in the Latino community and what they have to say about all of this and what they've thought as they've watched this kind of push from Sheridan, from some Republicans on the Board of Supervisors, like you mentioned, to get rid of the monitor, to end this case. They were the ones that pushed to get Arpaio out of office, to force change at this department. What do they think about all this?
Well, I think there's a lot of skepticism, and I think this also predates Sheridan. Even before he was in office, you had Paul Pinzon, who was a Democrat, and he ended up having to step down. Partly, he cited because of the court imposed requirements on the department. And so I think because given Sheridan's history, you know, having worked for Sheriff Arpaio, the fact that he was held in contempt of court back in 2016 for undermining some of the court reforms, they kind of viewed that initially right off the block as kind of like as a disadvantage, to a barrier towards building trust. And so as the year has progressed, you know, the sheriff has moved to end oversight altogether, along with the county board of supervisors. And so a lot of the activists, a lot of the Latino community members kind of see this as, well, if this is the move now, what's going to happen? What's mm-hmm. the end goal for him releasing or trying to get rid of court oversight? And their concern, of course, is that in the moment that we're in, that it could lead to, you know, greater participation or collaboration between the sheriff's office and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, even though Sheridan has told me multiple times over the course of this reporting that he has no interest in pursuing any more immigration agreements with ICE.
Right. He says we are not going to do that. We cannot do that right now anyway. But hanging over all of this, of course, is the Trump administration's mass deportation plan. And they have really expanded those local agreements with local law enforcement agencies over the last 1.5, 2 years here. So are activists concerned about that and what that could lead to?
That's a question that I think comes time again in speaking to activists, and I think that the bulk for the main reason for that is the fact that there are ICE agents already stationed inside the Maricopa County intake facility. So mm-hmm. this is the place where all detainees, you know, get sent in, and there are two ICE agents that are given physical space so that they screen anybody who is booked into that. And so they kind of view that already as a base for collaboration and kind of are concerned that it could escalate okay. even further from that point. But it definitely is a big priority for the Trump administration. There are over 1,000 agreements now, though. I have to note that the majority of departments in Arizona are not signing on. There are just a handful,
yes.
You know, less than half dozen that have signed on in okay. the second Trump administration. And most of those are not for task forces. Okay. They're for enforcement on the jails.
Yeah. Sorry, we'll have to leave it there. That is Rafael Carranza, reporter with Arizona Luminaria, joining us. Rafael, thank you very much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how Valley-born rock band The Format balanced their role as entertainers with a desire for activism and community building. But first, as climate change becomes a more lived reality for us all, hottest winter on record here, more of us are experiencing something called climate grief, a sense of loss and existential anxiety about what's to come. Well, a new breed of spiritual caregivers are stepping in to help, and they're called eco-chaplains. The care they offer is for anyone, from those who are involved in the climate world, like environmentalists, activists, community organizers, the journalists who cover it, or even disaster survivors. Think of it as landing somewhere between professional pastoral care and spiritual practice. Nikayla Jefferson is one of them. She is a Buddhist eco-chaplain as well as a writer, and she wrote about eco-chaplaincy recently for Yale Climate Connections. I spoke with her more about it, and she told me her story with eco-chaplaincy began in 2019 when she was working as an organizer for the Sunrise Movement, a political action nonprofit focused on climate change.
When you're working on an issue like climate change, it's not long before the existential elements really begin to sink in. And I found myself really, for the first time, grappling with something like mass extinction and the end of life as I know it. And I was, you know, I'm 29 now. I was 22 at the time. And there was just, felt like no ground beneath my feet. I felt like there was no place I could go to sort of like process this grief and kind of come to terms with things. So I had a spiritual crisis of sorts. And through the journey of that, that's how I found this program and finding an inner commitment to help others who are having some spiritual existential challenges stemming from this transformation of our planet that we're experiencing right now. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you discovered this maybe sooner than most folks, because this is, you know, becoming, I think, more recognized now, this idea of climate grief that you're describing, this existential crisis that many of us are trying to grapple with. I don't think most people kind of identify what that is. Mm. How did you come to terms with it? Like, when you started studying this, have you resolved this for yourself, or is this ongoing?
No, this is absolutely, I don't know anyone who's resolved it. It is a lifelong journey. You know, one I'll be in for as long as I'm a human on this planet Earth.
Yeah.
But I feel like now I've arrived in a place where I feel grounded and safe and secure enough in myself and the people around me and this land that I'm on and my home, that I feel a certain degree of confidence that I'll be okay, kind of no matter what heads my way.
So let's talk about being an eco chaplain and what this looks like and this kind of emerging field that seems pretty small still. I think it's interesting that this is coming as like a religious or spiritual kind of guidance as opposed to like from the counseling psychology world in a more secular way. And it seems like this is, you know, an interfaith practice.
Mm-hmm. What I love about eco chaplaincy is we're really just trained to be really great spiritual friends to whoever may come our way in need. And I think we all sort of make use of our individual gifts and abilities and lean into whatever life experiences that we've had up to this point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some people lead like nature-based workshops for groups, may guide like an earth-based meditation, leading a ritual or a ceremony. And this can, you know, be from like a wedding day up to like honoring a landscape that was lost after a wildfire. People may show up and support activists and organizers as they're, you know, working on a campaign or a protest. Eco chaplains really just go wherever there is a need, and they show up as a spiritual friend the best they can, and it looks different for everybody.
So talk about what it is that you hear from folks who seek out this kind of care. Are they depressed? Are they anxious?
Yeah, I think there are some people who are really aware that their anxiety, their grief, the distress, the pain that they're in right now is related to the climate and ecological changes. But there are some people who are carrying pain and grief that is related, but they're unaware. I was talking to Chris Godot-Jones, who's in this piece. He's a psychotherapist and also a chaplain of the traditional variety. But he was telling me that a lot of his clients may come in about something, you know, about a relationship or a job. And when they begin to unpack the grief or the anxiety or like a sense of loss, climate change is like lingering somewhere in the background. And he told me that, you know, once he kind of names and normalizes, you know, eco anxiety or grief, it really gives people the space to open up about it in a way they felt like, you know, they haven't been able to, either because, you know, maybe there's a stigma around it, maybe they weren't aware of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. One of the things that came to mind for me here when I was reading your piece and also just kind of thinking about this topic is that I know many people, I think, around my generation, like the millennial generation, who have decided not to have kids. And they'll say because of climate change, you know, because they're too scared about the future of the world. I mean, do you see things like that come up in conversation?
I mean, yeah, I'm one of them. Absolutely. There's just no right answer. And as the eco chaplain, like, I'm not there to give somebody an answer. Yeah. I'm really just there to create space for them to find an answer for themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you mind telling us personally, when you think about, you know, the idea of having children, what does that bring up for you? And I'm sure those are common themes in the work that you do.
Yeah. I mean, on one hand, like, you know, I really try to stay in the present, but when it comes to the topic of children, like, I can't help but jump like 40 years, you know, down the line here and imagine, for like better or worse, what life could look like on this earth. And the imaginations, you know, they go both ways. Either we've really figured it out and we're living in this time of like wonder and abundance and possibility, or things have taken a turn for the worse. And we're living in a moment right now that I feel like it truly could go either way. Hmm. So I feel like my answer to this question is really going to be shaped by whatever happens over the next, like, you know, 3 to 5 years.
That's really interesting. It does feel like a moment like that. So let me ask you then, like, as you're trying to, you know, hear people and be with them in these moments and help them come to their own conclusions about how they would like to address this issue, do you often try to encourage them to take action in small ways? I hear a lot of people say that with climate change, like, you know, do the things that you can do in your own community, and that will help you feel better about this big existential problem. Because it is, in the end, like, not a problem that each of us individually can solve.
Right. I'll say, as an eco-chaplain, I really try to hold not being prescriptive. You know, I don't want to tell anybody what to do. I think when you try to tell somebody what to do, often you encounter walls. But I also think that, you know, doing something, it feels good. It's empowering. Being with others when you're doing something, you know, it feels even better. So I feel like oftentimes I don't need to tell anybody to do that.
Yeah.
I think if you allow someone to follow the wisdom within for enough time, I think a lot of people end up there eventually on their own. And when you arrive at something on your own, you feel so much more, it feels like your own truth. And I think people being grounded in their own truth and acting from that truth is, I think it's one of the most beautiful things that I can do.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a good place to end it. We'll leave it there. That is Nikhayla Jefferson, a writer as well as a Buddhist eco-chaplain, joining us to tell us more about that field. Nikhayla, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for discussing this with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Lauren. Great to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Well, it's that time of year when much of the valley turns a shade of yellow as Palo Verde trees bloom. It's a telltale sign of spring, especially in a region where spring can sometimes feel more like summer, especially this year. But unlike other places that celebrate signs of the seasons, think cherry blossoms in D.C., you tend to not see that kind of thing as much here. Jen Urso, a valley artist, joined my co-host Mark Brody last spring to talk about why yellow blooms can be just as good as pink ones.
Well, it always feels like a magical time of the year. In fact, just the other day, I was sitting in a traffic light with my son in the car and looking at this tree next to like a McDonald's, and, you know, it's bursting in yellow and yellow all over the ground. And I said, you know, isn't this just amazing? Like, it's this time of year where everything is just painted in yellow here. And then he pointed out that it matched the McDonald's logo. I said, yes, very on brand.
Yeah. I mean, so for some of us, obviously, this time of year means a trip to get your allergy shots. But like for a lot of people, this can really feel like sort of how we in the valley identify spring, because we don't really have, you know, the cold winters. We are forced to stay inside. And, you know, like me, you're from the East Coast originally. Like, there's just a sort of a different way of marking the time, it seems, here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the first time, I don't know if like the having moved here from Pennsylvania, like about 30 years ago, I don't know if I really noticed it right away. Like, it didn't really register to me that this was something that was cyclical. But then it started to become a thing of like, what is happening when everything is yellow, you know? And then it sort of slowly dawns on me that, oh, it's, you know, connected, you know, just even as a person myself, who I feel is pretty connected to nature, I still had that disconnect of understanding that this was something specific to this place that is really special, that happens at a very specific time of the year.
So why is it then that, like, there's not more attention? Like, it seems like the Palo Verde blooms don't get the love that, you know, cherry blossoms do in D.C. I mean, people don't flock here this time of year to see this the way they do in Washington, D.C. and other places that have similar kinds of sort of especially spring rituals.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just an unfortunate consequence of Phoenix being believed to be this place that could be anything, you know, by settlers who came in and thought, okay, well, it's this blank slate. We can plant whatever we want. We can grow whatever we want, you know? So it's like this embedded lack of appreciation of what's indigenous to this area. I mean, I think the pride of Phoenix and of the Sonoran Desert has changed a lot, at least since I've been here. Mm-hmm. So I think people are embracing it more. I mean, I did hear recently that there was a blossom festival at the Acatia restaurant, I think by some landscape architect, like a landscape architect group.
Okay.
So there's definitely, I think, a better appreciation. But I remember there being a time when people were like complaining about it. Like, oh, God, all this yellow. And I'm like, how can you complain about this? This is unbelievable. You know, this is beautiful. These blossoms are falling around us and cast, you know, raining on us. And I don't know how that could be turned into a thing that anyone could complain about.
I mean, I guess maybe if you have to, you know, brush them off your windshield all the time or, you know, sneezing, stuff like that could be the only complaint.
It seems a small price to pay for, you know, like natural beauty.
Sure. So like, how do you try to use this, especially the Palo Verde bloom in the work that you do? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you maybe try to highlight a little bit to try to, you know, get people to appreciate this kind of thing in this time of year more?
Well, for me, what I appreciate about a lot of native plants and what I try to do, especially in my own piece of land, is having plants that have a really good, what they call leaf drop. So, you know, it helps enrich the soil. So as long as you're not, you know, what's the word? The leaf blower, like getting dust blower, blowing everything yeah. away, and you're letting that stuff drop, it's really helping the soil become, you know, richer. There's a healthier biome. You know, so for me, like I have a blue Palo Verde in my yard, which I guess actually blooms a lot earlier than some of the hybrid Palo Verdes that you see around town. I wasn't afraid to have the one with the thorns. but like, it's such an appreciation for me because like my goal is to really try to get the soil in my yard back to where it should be, or, you know, where it was originally before it was hit with like chemicals and gravel and landscape fabric and all this kind of stuff. And it is slowly getting to that point. So, you know, creosote's a really good example of something that drops so many wonderful leaves and it creates yeah. like a really good mulch at the base of the plant. So I think of it as, you know, it's just a way of the desert protecting its soil for, you know, for this summer, the brutal summer that's coming up. It allows a harbor for insects and microbes and, you know, leaf blowing it all away is kind of defeating the purpose of what this tree, this wonderful tree that survives our environment, is trying to do, you know?
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Valley artist Jen Urso taking the time to appreciate the yellow Palo Verde blooms. Jen, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Awesome to talk to you. Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Americans are aging, and that means more will be diagnosed with dementia in the coming years. And our next guest has a new way to understand the way they experience the world. Surrealism. That's right, the 20th century avant-garde art movement. Dr. Jason Karlowish is co-director of the Penn Memory Center and writes a column for STAT called Neurotransmissions. I spoke with him more about it, beginning with where this idea came from for him. Where else? An art museum.
I live in Philadelphia, and just down the street from my home is the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and they have just wrapped up an exhibition called Dream World, Surrealism at 100. And I was going through that exhibition, and as I was looking at the images, I began to think about my patients' experiences when they look at images. And to put a word to it, I think their experiences are oftentimes surreal.
Hmm.
And I began to make this connection between my work as a physician caring for people living with diseases that cause dementia, like Alzheimer's, and my experience looking at these uncanny images that were in this exhibition.
Let's talk a little bit about how it is that the brain works, that consciousness works. Like, you talk about the actual mechanics of that and how this kind of applies to, you think, people experiencing dementia. Walk us through the idea of how it is that our brain is conscious of something and then how dementia disorders that consciousness.
Yeah. So all of us have a mind. All of us humans have a mind. And that mind is the product of the unconscious and conscious worlds. Our unconscious is constantly at work, taking in a host of sensory information. Thank God we're not aware of 99% of it, otherwise we'd go mad. But there's this interesting border between the conscious and the unconscious where something happens, something we, quote, need to know, need to be aware of, need to hear, need to feel, and we're aware of it. And, you know, in a brain of a normally functioning, developed human brain, that generally works to allow us to see things the way they more or less are. But for persons with dementia, that can get distorted. That feed of what's perceived and then fed into conscious can be distorted and disrupted. And I recount in the essay a patient of mine, Nancy, who was looking at what we call the Navan figure. And the Navan figure is a giant letter, in this case, a giant letter H, constructed of multiple little tiny S's.
Yeah.
And the question is, what do you see? And most people say, well, I see a bunch of S's and there's a big H that's, you know, or something like, and I see an H made up of S's.
Sure.
And she could only see the S's. She couldn't see the big picture. And that's this distortion between her ability to take in sensory, put it into her consciousness, and see the whole picture. And that's just one example of, I think, many of the distortions in mind that persons living with dementia experience, and that interplay between what's constantly being taken in subconsciously and then put forward across into the border of the conscious.
Yeah.
And for persons with dementia caused by diseases like Alzheimer's, that's oftentimes, that's typically disrupted.
Yeah. So, I mean, interestingly, when you look at something that is surrealistic, I think it comes out of this time in American history. It's, you know, a 100-year anniversary show you were looking at the Philadelphia Museum of Art there, in which we were trying to make sense of some kind of mind-blowing things, some things that were hard to wrap our heads around. Do you think that makes sense? Like, it even rang true in terms of the origins of this type of art?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, surrealism was a product of early 20th century events, in particular, the horrific events of the slaughter, the mechanized slaughter that was World War One. You know, André Breton, many of the surrealists were participants in that war. Breton was a medic, for example. And I think part of the sort of horrors of mechanized slaughter led them to want to sort of look within and try to free themselves of some of the orders of the world that led the world to that awful war. And as I think about the 21st century, I don't like to think of dementia like a war, but I do think it presents many of those kinds of challenges that kind of a world war does, you know, to a society. So there's an interesting kind of parallel between major events that cause us great angst and looking within World War One and dementia. And I think surrealism has a new way for us to make sense of this new problem we have, which is the vast problem that is dementia.
Right. And you write about what a vast problem it is and how we will need solutions and lenses like this, because we're an aging population in this country. Like, this is the first time in which we'll have so many people of older age who will suffer from things like this.
Yeah. Yeah. The fastest growing age group in America is persons over the age of 80. And the risk for developing dementia, whether it's from Alzheimer's, Lewy body disease, vascular disease, combinations thereof, takes off after about the age 75. And you know, the insight that I have had and I wrote about was how looking at surrealist art helps me understand what it is like to be a person living with dementia.
Yeah.
What it is like to, you know, for example, I had family members who tell me, I can't stand going to the grocery store with my relative, my wife, my husband. Well, she won't keep up with me. You know, she just follows me. And and that's a very common complaint. And I said, well, you know, their perception of the world is not like yours and mine. They struggle to put together all these objects and make sense of them. You know, back to my patient who couldn't see the letter H, made up of all the S's. And that's why they're following you, because you're the one thing they can see and kind of know what it is. It's not because they're weak. It's not because their joints hurt. It's because, like, I'm just holding on to the one thing I can see, I can make sense of in this vast, crowded grocery store with all these visual things coming at me from everywhere. And that really hit me as I looked at these pieces at the Surrealism exhibit. That's what it must be like for my patients. Wow.
That's fascinating. Yeah, yeah, that's a wow moment. And you talk about how this Surrealist aesthetic could help shed some insight on one of these debates within dementia care, which is sort of like, do we insist on the truth for people living in this kind of distorted reality? Or is it okay to sort of let people live in an unreal version of reality?
Or just not worry about reality,
right,
and be surreal. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the classic one, you know, robotic pets, you know, and there's a role for these pets, you know, that behave in many ways like a kind of living cat, dog, whatever. But of course, you know, I think many of us find it extremely sort of disturbing when we see someone playing with a robotic cat as though it was alive, and it's disturbing. And that's why I admire, for example, robotic seals, because people don't have seals for pets. Maybe some Inuits do, but you know, the average person in Philadelphia does not have a pet seal. And so I think it frees us of, you know, I'm not lying to her and pretending this is a cat or insisting, no, it's a toy cat. Why don't you accept it's a toy cat? I'm just saying, look, it's a seal. You know, it's, of course there's no seals in you know, this nursing home in Philadelphia, but if you enjoy it and it's giving you comfort and calm, so be it. And so I think it, the surrealist aesthetic is a way to just sort of set aside the sort of, do I lie or do I deceive, and say, let's just enter the surreal world and not worry about whether it's true or not, but just let it be.
So you're almost saying like surrealism is giving you a lens into this different kind of consciousness and just letting that be okay.
Well, accepting that that is what's the way this individual is,
yeah,
and I should meet them where they are. And yeah. Exactly.
Okay. We'll leave it there. That is Dr. Jason Karlowish, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, as well as co-director of the Penn Memory Center. He writes a column for Stat called Neurotransmissions and joins us to talk more about one of his latest columns. Thank you so much, Dr. Karlowish, for coming on. I really appreciate your take here.
Thank you, Lauren. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Beloved Valley rock band The Format is currently on tour in support of their new album, Boycott Heaven. It's the band's first full-length record in 20 years, and co-founders Nate Roos and Sam Means couldn't wait to get out on the road and introduce fans to the new songs. But just as the tour was getting underway, Alex Preti was killed by ICE agents in Minneapolis. The incident prompted some soul-searching for Roos and Means. What exactly was the purpose of making music? Those deliberations have now led to a series of events they're calling Saturdays in the Park. The idea is deceptively simple. In cities where they're already booked to play a show, they're adding a daytime event to the schedule. Roos and Means set up a stripped-down stage in a local park and invite local community organizations to set up tables. The events are free, and the goal is to let their music be an invitation to get involved. Sam Means recently spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about the origins of the series.
This album had been like 20 years in the making, basically. Mm-hmm. So there's that emotion behind it. And then that weekend of this album coming out for us was, you know, meant to obviously be a big celebration. But then, as is typical with the world around us today, you know, something horrible happens. And sometimes it makes it really difficult to celebrate something that you should be able to celebrate because there's just this messed up stuff happening. So we had this song called The Bar Set So Low that didn't end up making it on the record. It's, you know, lyrically really kind of speaks to a lot of the stuff specifically that's going on with this situation with ICE. And this, it's an ongoing situation that we know this stuff has all been happening for a long time.
I was born in this cage. I watch, call a swap. But still nothing changes, only the lock. It's getting harder to break.
Hey, so, you know, that morning, Nate was like, hey, do you think we should try to play the song today? I was like, yes, absolutely. You know, so we decided to play it at the end, sort of as the closer, because, you know, we didn't want to. It's tough because you still want to find this balance. I mean, Nate's spoken on this a couple times of like finding this balance of people. Sometimes people just want to go to a concert to escape the horrible things that are happening. It's not that it's a distraction, but like you still have to find joy in things, you know. So
right, you don't want these events to become the like defining fabric of your entire life.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's not. I mean, that may be who we may be becoming more sort of socially responsible as people, but we're still a band and entertainers that are, you know, there to entertain people in a certain way. So, but we also don't want to We didn't want to overlook what was happening. It just felt important. Mm-hmm. So, we played the show, and yeah, so we just kind of debuted the song to the world at that show. We closed it out, and they gave a real nice a speech about why we were doing it and why it was important to us, and the crowd really responded to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, would it be fair to say, is it too neat a narrative that kind of the seeds of this idea of doing these outdoor performances in parks as a way of getting people together around music and inviting them to then through that get involved in other organizing efforts. Were the seeds of that kind of born out of this experience?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we were in Seattle on the airport because we got there a little early, and I think our flight was delayed and they kept changing our gates. We just were like walking back and forth and back and forth and reflecting on, we were just sort of like, this is really exciting, but also it seems like maybe we could be doing more. And so we just started talking about that. We started talking about music that we were into from when we were kids and like punk bands that we listened to. And the conversation then was more so like, you know, it's just really sad because you can go back and listen to lyrics from the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. And like every generation has these protest songs and protest bands and things where, you know, really positive messages to try to steer society, you know, like help steer society through entertainment towards like a better way. And a lot of good things have come out of that. But at the end of the day, it still seems like we're moving towards like, we haven't figured it out yet. Like there's still a lot of more work to do.
That's really interesting though. I'm glad you brought this up. We just had a conversation along similar lines on the show here this past week. And there is a lot of talk about that right now, as I'm sure you know, about should musicians be doing more? Should music be doing more? It sounds like this is something you and Nate have been really kind of turning over for yourselves.
I think, yeah. I mean, you get comments where people are like, hey, stick to music or whatever, and that stuff happens. And it's I always think that is hilarious because you have to do what you can. People ultimately just want to be comfortable and they do want to be entertained and they want to be able to sort of like check out from their day at work and just like listen to an album. But there's been quite a bit of activism and sort of underlying messages going on in a lot of these songs for all time.
Yeah. You know? Well, so one of the reasons I'm interested in this, Sam, is it feels like it's pretty closely related to the format, if I may, of the events, the Saturdays in the Park events, because please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like what you guys are leading with here is getting people to come out together and listen to music. And then, oh, by the way, by coming out to this event, you're also going to be kind of organically connected to all of these organizations that are doing work you might be interested in getting involved in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we were in sort of that walk in Seattle to kind of go back to that. We were just talking like, well, what can we do? You know, like what else could we do? The vision for this was like, I just feel like we just need like a soapbox and a microphone, and it's just very grassroots and it's just welcoming. It's important to go to protests, and I've been to some and they're cool, but for like an average person, it might be alarming. You know, there's people with megaphones yelling at you and trying to get your attention, which they need to be doing because people need to know what's happening. But we thought, well, maybe there's a good balance here too with this, and we can just have it be a show, but not really, you know, we're just kind of like, we'll play a couple songs, we're talking about it, and then invite people to speak and then play a couple more songs and then invite another band up.
Yeah. You know?
And it's only, it's like 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's not a huge thing to a huge commitment, and just kind of walk up and leave whenever you need to, you know.
Yeah.
It's really easy. We just wanted to make it easy, and we thought it would be cool for a thing where like fans could come, but also a thing where people might just walk up and be like, what is this?
Right, right. I'm wondering what it's like for you to perform knowing that the music is going to be received in an explicitly politicized context. Does it change the way you think about it from a performance standpoint or the way you experience the songs?
I mean, I do think it's cool because I think people might listen to the lyrics a little bit more in that context, you know? But I also think it's cool too, just to have, you know, maybe normal, happy songs that shows that regular people do have to sort of start paying attention too. Like there should be a blend of normalcy, normal people that are just like getting through life. And then also the importance of maybe stepping into some slightly uncomfortable territory.
Yeah. Well, I have been speaking with Sam Means, one of the founding members of The Format, currently on tour in support of their record Boycott Heaven, and also doing these Saturdays in the Park community music events. Sam, thank you for this conversation.
Yes, thank you.
I was taken from my mother's arms and caught it up, caught it blind. What would I do for a slave wage and some hard problems? Out of pocket, out of context, lose. Get away, get away, get away, 'cause the fear has gotten hold. And I'm struggling. It's a shame, it's a shame, it's a shame that the bar is set so low. I'm caught under it.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We'll leave you with some format to nod along to. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show and sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.